What's up?
Watching Ant-Man earlier today.
Oh, nice.
He comes rolling up. He's like, What's up? What? No, remember the commercial? What's up?
Oh, God, I can't. Yeah, I can't pull it.
That guy's great. He does a lot of different stuff.
Totally. Yeah. Oh, God. He has some really funny shit, man.
Welcome back to the Pacific Novel Project. I am your host, Jason Peterson, and my co-host is Steve Childress.
Hey, what's up out there?
This is the podcast where we demonstrate the writing process from start to finish, from first draft to getting it published. And we do it by workshopping our own novels and putting them out there for all the friendly internet people to warmly embrace us.
It's a labor of love, really.
So join us on Patreon at patreon.com/Pacific Novel Project. If you'd like to see any more of our work, we have a lot of goodies and tiers and really just things that we hope will get people involved in the writing process and talking about writing and reading and books and all the great stuff that comes with all of us literary files.
And whatever voice files. And whatever voice in your head is telling you not to, just tell it to take a hike and come visit us at Patreon. You'll thank yourself. Maybe.
We are also going up on YouTube, and we'll be on iTunes pretty soon, if not already. So anywhere we are, please like and subscribe. This podcast is free. We got some other stuff that's free, and we got some stuff that, you know, is only available for a few dollars. And as always, we appreciate anybody who joins us there. All right, Steve, we started with me last time, and we're going to start with you this time.
All right, cool.
Where are we in this story? So they found the murdered girl in the beginning. Then they took the body to the morgue, found the wound in the back of her head, found the Nazi pocket watch, had a chat with, we met Abbott, the captain. I appreciated that he was, you know, kind of he was like no nonsense business like dude, but you know, he was like, 40, get your ass in here.
Yeah, he wasn't definitely wasn't the captain from Last Action Hero.
I didn't see that movie.
It was actually pretty good for, you know, what it was.
I watched it for like 15 minutes.
Fair enough.
So, I mean, I don't know. I couldn't hang with it. Maybe it was just the time. Anyway, that captain was the captain from Beverly Hills Cop.
Was that the same guy?
No, it was a different dude. I'm just saying that was the movie. I don't know. I don't remember seeing the captain. I was just saying, you know, Foley, get your ass in here.
Right. Kind of had that trope. Yeah, I got you.
Axel Foley
was great.
My son, Alec, when he was like six, told me his favorite actor was Eddie Murphy. I was like, what Eddie Murphy movies have you been watching?
I know, right?
And then I realized, you know, Haunted Mansion, Nutty Professor. I was like, oh my God, he became a kids actor. When that happened?
I think it happened when he, I don't know.
When he had kids.
Didn't he do Flubber also?
No, Flubber was
Robin Williams.
So anyway, when he turned 16, I said, all right, it's time to introduce you to the Eddie Murphy I know. And we watched Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh, nice. That's cool.
I thought about 48 hours, but I thought that might be a little bit intense to a first time.
I think so. Yeah, might be a little bit.
Anyway, we are now following up investigating this pocket watch, which is found on the girl's body and maybe a clue to what's happening. Farley Repair Shop. May 23rd, 1941. I have not been paying attention to the dates on this read-through, so if they're out of order, I'm not going to be able to let you know.
Fair enough.
I made some line suggestions here to tighten up the script a bit. Or maybe I should say prose. This isn't an actual script. Or would it be considered a script? I don't consider it a script. The bell above the door to Farley Watch Repair rings as Monty and I enter. The uniform tick of a multitude of clocks that hang from the walls and sit on the shelves is unnerving. So that was my suggestion. It made two sentences out of kind of like two and a half sentences. Did I read this right? That when he goes in there, all the clocks are ticking in unison.
Yes.
That is a little creepy.
I thought it was too. That's why I was like, oh, dude, I got to do this. It kind of reminded me of Doc's garage when Marty goes by and all the clocks are there ticking. Oh, yeah. And yeah.
Yeah, it is. I mean, on one hand, I kind of admire the precision of detail that would have taken to do. On the other hand, I'm like, oh, man, that must be weird standing in there.
Totally.
So they go in. There's an old dude there. He is fixing a clock. Monty comes up. Well, they just kind of like they show him his badge. And he just kind of like ignores them until they badge him. He asks what they need. You can see I just have a lot of a lot of sentence suggestions here. The Watchman asks him what he needs. Monty introduces him and Tomb. Did I write down? Oh, I didn't write down why specifically I suggested these changes. Most of it was just to make it flow a little easier. The Watchmaker introduces himself, and he says that it's some nice work. Oh, what was this part? Please. Oh, I thought I highlighted this. It's not highlighted. What was? I'm going to highlight it now. Where it says, the shopkeeper's glance at my fingers and turns into a glare when our eyes meet. Bottom of page 32. I probably should have said page 32 to start out with. Please, Detective Tomb, stop. What was he? What was his deal?
He was tapping his fingers on the glass countertop.
Was it just the tapping in general? Not like he's afraid he's going to break something?
No, it was counterintuitive to the ticking of the unison clocks.
He was out of time with the rest of the... Okay.
I could probably make that more clear.
Maybe. Or would he be doing it with unison, because accidentally, like without thinking about it?
I suppose he could.
But that's funny. I think that's a funny idea that the clocks are like tick, and he's like doomp, tick, doomp, tick, doomp. Page 33. He checks out the watch. Got his little glasses. What are those glasses called? Do those glasses have a name? They seem to think, I think they should have a name. You know, we're talking about the glasses that have all the little magnifying glasses that you swing in front of them. Would they be called jeweler's glasses, or are those different?
I think they're all jeweler's glasses, I think. That was, because I found some glasses online that had the different magnifiers that you could put up and pull down, and they were usually referred to as jeweler's glasses or something like that.
I wonder if you should call them. I think you should probably call them that.
Probably.
On first reference. I'm not going to note that because I think I asked that somewhere here.
Yeah, you did.
All right. Oh, you know what? I see I asked it. And then I had this question. Is he a watchmaker? Because you refer him to that. Or is he a watch repairman? Or is he both? Is there a name for that? And by name for that, I mean 20 slang. That's a boring modern name.
Yeah, I didn't find anything. I kind of looked around a little bit, but I didn't want to spend too much time on it.
Yeah. If you come up with something too weird, then you'll just sound like a freaking comic book villain.
True.
All right, so he doesn't have anybody who's requesting any of this work, so he recommends a couple places. Gary Mall at Mall Jewelers and Anton Richter, who is the guy who used to frequent Lou's place back when it was a speakeasy. I didn't really have much to say on page 33. Page 34. page 34, Tomb says, they're talking about Anton, and Tomb says, the jeweler's like, oh yeah, Anton did all these great things preserving treasures in World War I, and Tomb's all, well, he got his return on that, that was no selfless gesture, and I was like, why is he being a dick to Anton?
Because it's true.
Well, maybe he helped and got his own stuff. Anyway, I was already under the impression that he kind of liked Anton. That was just kind of mean. I just felt like he's sober, and so he's pissed off about it.
Yeah, there's, you know, something there.
All right, in the middle of the page, the paragraph that starts with, yeah, Monty says, walking around his Plymouth. So Tomb walks outside, lights up a cigarette, and then he tosses it away and gets inside the car. My comment is, smoke's supposed to be cheap back then. Is he not allowed to smoke in the car? I mean, that just seemed weird. Why is he lighting up a cigarette when he's just going to get rid of it right away? Couple lines down. But if you're one of the shufflers dragging their feet... Oh, I kind of like this. I'm going to read this whole thing here. It's a quiet ride back to Wilcox. People shuffle or rush down the sidewalks, and other cars swerve in and out of traffic. There's always an audition, a screen test, a table read to race off to. But if you're one of the shufflers dragging their feet to go wash dishes or serve bouncers of the Tinseltown dance, then maybe this scenery isn't your thing. So I just kind of like that reflection on the type of people who are in Hollywood. I just highlighted this one part that wasn't very clear. Go wash dishes or serve the bouncers of the Tinseltown dance. Was the Tinseltown dance people walking around?
The gatekeepers of what is Hollywood. They're kind of the bouncers of Hollywood. You know, like the people that go, okay, you got the part or you don't have the part. Or we just don't like the way that, you know, you tie your shoes and you don't love Jesus. So you don't get to act.
Yeah. Oh, you're not blowing me. Okay.
I'll have to figure out a way to reword that.
Yeah, that's super unclear.
It really is. Looking at it now, I'm like, oh, damn it.
Let's see. But if you're an Anton, Hollywood is a playground. High-class skirts, getting snowed up. I assume that's coke.
That is.
Rubbing shoulders with gangsters from Chicago. All right, that's it on that page. Page 35. I deleted grimacing. It just didn't seem like an odd place. Believe me, I'd rather not visit the place we owe it to that poor girl, I say grimacing. And how does he know I always have this problem with the first person. How does he know what his face looks like?
Ah, fair enough. But
I don't think I like that word grimacing. Say what?
I guess you know when you grimace. I mean, it's kind of a conscious thing.
Well, I don't know. I feel like I'm smiling really big half the time people tell me I'm not smiling.
That's all perception. Don't let other people tell you you're not happy, Jason.
Thanks, Steve. All right, near the bottom, Silvermatic Studios, May 23rd, 1941. You know, I was thinking about these dates.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if maybe you just put the date once.
Oh, okay.
Like in the beginning of the chapter.
Okay.
May 23rd, and then we know it's May 23rd.
So do you like the chapters by date, maybe?
Oh, you could do that. I was thinking just like the way you have it here, Silvermax Film Studio, May 23rd. I was kind of just thinking May 23rd, right, you know, the first thing under the chapter heading.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. And just leave that as like the main date for like all the preceding, all the after body stuff.
Yeah. I wonder if it'd be easier to keep track, then you won't have like, you know, three or four dates on one day. Because unless you're telling me the time, then what difference is then? Like if you're doing the times, I can see putting the date with it too.
Okay.
It's very Dragnet.
Definitely falls in the trope, that's for sure.
Let's see. Silvermac Film Studios, May 23rd, 1941. I mean, yeah, we even got the year there. We kind of know that. My rusted bucket. I just changed it to rust. My rust bucket, which I think might actually be one word. All right. We're at Silvermac Film Studios. And the reason we're going there is because his buddy Danny DeLuca from his booze running days runs the studio and he's trying to find out if this girl's an actress. This is the bottom of page 35. I just have this one part. Damn it, I say and repeat it as I hit the steering wheel a few more times. He's at the gate of the studio. Is he trying to honk his horn? I guess was my question. Or was he just like angry and beating on his steering wheel? Like I couldn't tell.
Just angry and beating on the steering wheel.
All right. Page 36, we get a little bit of flashback. He hasn't seen Danny since Vivian died. And this part kind of surprised me a little bit. Vivian's deathbed letter, because she died from tuberculosis, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
About how she was banging Danny and Anna was not his daughter. And I'm not sure how I feel about that, although that might be one of the many suggestions I made.
Sort of, yeah.
I think him knowing that now in relation to their kind of like, you know, sweet little dinner they had earlier in the story, I'm kind of like, I don't know if that scene would play out like that.
Maybe not. I don't know. I'll have to revisit that.
What if something I've been thinking about since I read this, what if it just said, I don't actually know who Anna's dad is.
That's fair.
Or maybe it's a terrible idea and you shouldn't do that at all.
I see what you did there.
Since one of the reasons the relationship with Anna was supposed to be like a light point in his life, now it's not really a light point anymore.
Well, maybe it is because he's the only one that carries the secret. And delusions are grand, man.
Hey, man, I'd be thinking about the time. I'd be staring at her going, man, is that bitch my daughter? I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't. Maybe I'm a nicer guy than I think I am.
I think you are.
So anyway, I don't know. I think of all the scenes I've read with Anna and I'm like, oh, man, those scenes feel like they need to be different if Anna's definitely not his daughter. But if it's like, oh, Anna might not be your daughter. Let me see here. So he contemplates that, and then he goes in. He talks to the guards. They show him to the studio. He mentions that DeLuca's movies suck, but that's not real the real purpose of the movie studio, which I kind of know the purpose because I've already read the first full draft, but Mr. DeLuca did not stop his life of crime. So he gets up there. I didn't really have anything. I just had one sentence, structure change, different suggestion, and that was it. So we get down to the bottom of that page and moving on to page 37. You've got that Mayan sacrifice scene in here. I think it's kind of cool to see that scene earlier I don't know if you're still going to have people die in there, but kind of cool to see that scene earlier than before that happens. Anyway, they're filming, and then he waits. Oh, so I had this word vegetation didn't seem right. A woman in ceremonial gown is brought out by two men in loincloths and necklaces made of animal claws, vegetation, shrunken head. I kind of get what you're saying there because I've seen those movie things like that, but that word just feels odd there. I'm wondering if maybe you can change it or just get rid of it. So he calls cut and yells at the dude because he added a couple words to his line and nothing else on 37, 38. Danny's a tall, big dude. And he asked Elijah, I don't know why I'm out on Elijah's name. He asked Elijah what he wants. It seemed, I think I would like to see a description of Danny here. What's the look on his face when he sees Elijah and they haven't spoken for a number of years, I think?
With Danny's description and all that, I was realizing that today on the way home, I was like, shit, I forgot to write Danny's description in there.
And really, I just want to see, I'm more interested in his like body language and stuff. So on page 38, last line of the second paragraph, second line of the second paragraph. As we walk down the hallway toward Danny's office, every 2 feet for 6 feet, there are movie posters lining the wall. Just a little unclear there. And then the last sentence, a signature is barely noticeable and is further proof of the elbows he found to rub elbows with in this town. I think that's saying that we're discussing a framed Citizen Kane poster, which has a signature. It doesn't say whose signature. I mean, is it the man Orson himself? Is it the director? I think you're saying he's got power to rub elbows with people, but the elbows he found to rub elbows with sounds a little odd. And then the sentence on the same page that starts with, yeah, what's your angle, buddy? Danny asks. He adjusts his vest and pulls a box of matches from his pockets. I think that's supposed to be vest.
Yes, supposed to be vest.
Okay. And page 39, he's asked, Obama 38, he asked about Nancy, and he's like, oh, yeah, I know Nancy. She didn't show up to a shoot. And then he asked the secretary, hey, yeah, what you know on this Nancy girl who didn't show up to the thing? Can't remember her last name. And then Anna replies, yes, Mr. DeLuca. And that rubs Elijah the wrong way because Anna works for him. Is she a talent scout? Is she a caster? Is she a secretary? She seems to have multiple roles here.
I'm going with, I don't think they quite had casting directors at this time. I still got to verify that. So I was just going to kind of like make her as like a general assistant where she kind of wears a couple different hats.
So my only real comment about that was if she's like the secretary performing secretary duties right now, wouldn't they have had to walk by her to get into that office?
Not necessarily if they went in the back door.
All right. I find that to be a reasonable answer, but I didn't see anything that would explain that in text. I was like, huh?
That's fair.
That's it, right?
Yep. Yeah. I didn't get a chance to go any further. I wanted to, but I ran out of time and I was like, I got to get this posted.
I see the Gagliardi. Wow. What a word. Where did you find that name? Gagliardi Warehouse.
I found it in 1930s census for common surnames.
Oh, okay. Well, I see that's on the page below. Or is that where we're going next, or you got more stuff to get into?
I think I might have a few more things to throw in before I take anything to the warehouse. And I got to figure out how I'm going to get Tomb and Monty to be the ones that get called to the warehouse. So,
okay, cool beans.
So you think I should probably make, if I'm going to do something in contention with Tomb being Anna's father, you think I should just make it unknown?
I think it'd be more interesting if it was ambiguous. I think it'd be a little bit easier on their relationship.
Okay.
Can't turn the screws all the time.
Well, should I have Danny carry the secret since Vivian's dead, or just have nobody know? Like she took it to her grave.
Oh, maybe that's why Danny's so nice. Well, Danny's the godfather anyway, right?
Anyway, yeah, he's a godfather anyway. And I see him as like, you know, taking that role as something that since he doesn't have kids of his own, he kind of takes that role seriously.
Yeah, kind of like that.
All right. Maybe I'll roll it that way then. So that way they're both kind of in the dark, but they're both also like not totally.
Because Danny might think that already because Danny knows that he was banging Vivian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Tomb could also have his suspicions. That's what kind of like grew that distance between them. I don't know. I'll have to play with that. Okay. So let's see. We're starting on Ghost of Silver Creek on page 24, right? With the where Cranston Brody comes down the stairs and he's all, what's all the ruckus, boys?
Yes, because I ended in the middle of a scene. I've been thinking about changing the town name.
Okay.
Because I got a silver. I got Silver Creek. I got Silver Tip.
Do you have any ideas of what you want to change it to?
No.
No? Okay. Well, I'll...
Doesn't matter? You don't think it matters?
I think it's fine. I mean, it goes with the theme. If it's a Silvertown, I could see possibly the person that, you know, founded it just going with a motif.
Yeah, at first I thought it was gonna be like, you know, first I started out there was just like a snow cat mountain. So Silvertip. And then I was kinda like, oh, maybe it's at the end of the creek, Silvertip. I just had it like when I originally created the town, it was like at the edge of something. But it's not really anymore.
I see.
You don't think it's too confusing, I could just keep it.
No, I mean, Silver Creek, Silvertip, what was the third?
Oh, now that I've introduced the canyon that's, you know, filled with the mines and stuff, they've been calling it Silvertip Canyon because it's just next to Silver, or Upper, they've been calling it Upper Silvertip or Silvertip Canyon or something like that.
Okay, I was going to say if you're going to change anything, maybe change the name of the canyon.
Okay.
Because I like Silvertip for the name of the town. I think it works well. It kind of has a pizzazz to it, a panache, if you will. I don't know. It rolls off the tongue well.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see. Okay. Yeah. And Teague kind of tells Joshua that Brody Cranston's basically a bully and gets what he wants through bullying or money or both. So, okay. And then Colt is the one that comes in with the men and they're drinking behind the bar and Colt staring Joshua down. Last we left off, Joshua was breaking bread with Sheriff Teague, and they were talking about, or Sheriff Teague was kind of introducing him to the nature of Silvertip and the Brodies and the Nestors and the nature of the politics around, and Brody kind of being, Cranston Brody basically being this land baron bully who has connections and kind of can get what he wants through bullying or money or both. We have several cowhands along with one of Cranston's sons, Colt, come in to the restaurant hotel and they go behind the bar. They're all shaken. Some of them are basically kind of scared. They have like a nervousness about them having been scared by this glowing entity that had come out of the corn at Charles Johnston's place where they had just come from after trying to, well, they burnt down his old house and they killed a bunch of chickens and they were basically terrorizing the settler. So Colt stares down Joshua and him and Joshua are both having this stare down. All of a sudden you hear Cranston Brody's voice. "What's all the ruckus, boys?" Cranston Brody said from the terrace above as he moved toward the stairs with Caroline on his arm and Andy behind him. "And what are you doing behind the bar on a Sunday, Timmy?" Uh-oh, we're going to need a new Timmy. And I like this. Joshua listened to the heavy footfalls of the old rancher come down the stairs behind him without moving his eyes from the young man at the bar, which was Colt. I liked that, you know, kind of that awareness that we get from Joshua. It has a similarity to the awareness we see from Sheriff Teague when Joshua is basically doing the same thing coming down the stairs. I didn't have a lot going on this page. I did make a word edit. Let's see. We took down the new place he was building and put down some animals for what they did to you last week. I just made a suggestion of tore instead of took down, but I guess it was really burnt down. But I guess tore down would work too.
Yeah, I'll probably modify that.
Okay. Alrighty. I like the body language here from Caroline when Timmy mentions a ghost, why they're all kind of shaken and off kilter. And Caroline, she says, "Sure, you must be mistaken," Caroline said, hand pressed to her chest as if to calm her heartbeat. It almost kind of has like that embodiment of like a swoon, like she's going to faint just from like the outlandishness of such a claim. It just had that Western feel to it, like just that time period of, oh Lord, you know. But anyway,
I declare I've become a bit faint.
I declare. Exactly. So let's see, moving on to 25. And in all this disbelievement, Cranston Brody asks, "How about you, Colt? You see a ghost, son?" And Colt, I like Colt. He kind of just plays it cool, even though he skinned out with the other men, and I'm sure he had to check his shorts as well. I liked the bravado, though, and juxtaposition of the other men around the bar, because he kind of, I guess he would be held to a higher account, maybe, because of who his father is and, you know, keeping up appearances or whatever. But Colt turned from Joshua to his father and shrugged. I can only speculate as to its nature, but it was something. Yeah, just that. I don't know. I think he was more jarred than what he's going to admit here.
I kind of pictured him being more calm by now. Now he's had some time to dwell on it since, you know, it's kind of a long ride back.
True. I could see him definitely being more calm now, but I don't think there's any way he would admit to having been shaken by it. Just how he comes in and he's like just already eyeing Joshua. He just seems to have like that acting attitude of like, you know, even if I mess my drawers, I'm not going to admit I did kind of thing. But anyway, let's see. I found this next dialogue. It was a little jarring for me. It was Colt. This is Joshua Stone, Cranston said. Colt and Joshua nodded to each other. See what kind of things are going on up there, Stone. The dialogue for me was jarring when I was going over it. It's like, is Cranston asking him if he'd been up there or if he sees what's going on through the ghost story?
Yeah, that's what it was. He just started talking about stuff. He's like, see what's happening?
Okay.
Apparently it's not working.
Yeah, just, I don't know. It took me out. Now that I'm rereading it again, because I read it like three times when I was reading it the other day, and I was like, it was just unclear.
And Newton is taking a nasty, smelly crap.
What's Newton did?
Yeah.
Oh boy, I'm sure that's a treat.
But the litter box is down here by the desk.
That's bad. Following that last thing, there was some contention that I came upon that I liked. If you paid attention to anything about me, you'd know my guns aren't for murdering families and lawmen. You got a lot of reasons to want the Nesters out. Now maybe it's not you, but something smells like manure. And I like that Joshua has called Branston out this early in their professional relationship compared to the earlier draft. And it also kind of helps bolster that idea that people have of Joshua due to, what was it, the mining camp? What happened at the mining camp?
His general reputation.
Oh, okay. So he's basically a gunman with a code. He'll work for you, but he's only going to work for you if you're on the up and up. And then the dialogue preceding the something here smells like manure. Tell your boys not to get twitchy. I've had my coffee and I'm feeling a bit jumpy right now. As is with that last piece of dialogue there, with starting with feeling, I think an action to break up the repetition of feeling could work well. Or if it's just a typo, then a fix might be considered.
You think feeling's repetitious from what?
I've had my coffee and feeling.
Oh, I'm feeling. Oh, yeah, that's a typo.
Yeah, so I was like, well, if you wanted to use feeling twice there in the dialogue, an action between the two, between feeling and I'm feeling, could work.
No, that just got an extra feeling from editing the sentence.
Okay, I wasn't sure, so I just, yeah, thought I'd bring it up. I mean, we'll just put the feelings aside.
Yes, let's keep it professional.
Okay. This isn't poetry, damn it.
That's right.
all those mushy, bad feelings. Let's see here. Will you be coming out the door or the window this time? Chalk said on the top of page 26. I like the implication here that this isn't Chalk's first time having to ask this question or witnessing such a scene. I don't know. It just has funny implications, and I liked it. And then there was a moment down in, see, a few paragraphs down. Andy's about to call Joshua yellow, and then Father barked his name and told him to shut up. And then Joshua could have sworn he saw Caroline release a small sigh of disappointment as basically the violence got shut down. And I noticed this wasn't the first moment with Caroline doing the passive-aggressive egging on. And what I'm wondering is, and this is going to be a huge spoiler, if I ask it now?
I know what you're going to ask me, and the answer is yes.
Okay, cool. Cool, because I was totally picking up on that. I was like, but then again, I have the advantage of having the prior draft under my belt, having read it. So yeah. So I think the first reader that would come upon, let's say, like this draft, definitely would still have that big reveal, and like Caroline would just like, this is how Caroline is.
Just another crazy Western bitch.
Right? I love me the violence. Oh, laws, yes. I'm going to be faint.
Our Southern accents all sound like Foghorn Leghorn.
Well, I say, I keep my feathers numbered for just such an occasion.
Did I tell you about reading in that voice in Civil War?
Uh-uh.
I was reading something from a Texas senator from the Civil War era. It's just, God, everything I read in that class was just horrible.
Oh my God, I can imagine.
So I started reading. I started reading in that Foghorn Leghorn.
Oh, that is so good.
My teacher was not amused.
Oh, was amused or was not amused?
Was not. Told me to stop.
What about the rest of the class? Were they amused or did they even get it?
I think a couple people thought it was funny. I think the others were just a little too stunned by my balls.
That's awesome.
I mean, they were all like freaking 18 to 20 year olds. I mean, they must not be on that, you know, liberal end, I assume. Although, I mean, I'm sure I know a lot of guys who are that age from the South who aren't liberal. So
true. But then again, they haven't had Looney Tunes on Saturday morning cartoons for quite some time. In fact, they haven't had Saturday morning cartoons in quite some time.
Anyway, she didn't appreciate me like my World War One teacher did. I made jokes in that class all the time and he would just make them right back at me.
Hey, that's cool. That's cool. I like teachers that
joke back. Yeah, we were talking about this law that England made that said unless you were born there, you couldn't be a citizen or something like that. And so somebody, for example, who if you were a German woman married to an English person, lived there all your life, you were still considered German and, you know, they're trying to kick people out of the country and or whatever. So they're like, if you were German, you would be considered German. If you were born to this type of parent, you know, even if you were born in the country, I mean, if you're born to this type of parent, you were, you know, Italian. If you were born to, if one of your parents was American, you were, and I said, you were a citizen of, and I said, of awesome. And his response was, oh, veterans and their knee-jerk patriotism are so cute.
That's a good answer. That's a good reply. Who was your teacher for that class? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was Jobes.
Jobes? I never had him for anything.
Oh, he was great.
Yeah, I ended up not doing really any history classes at Pacific because that would have just made like way too many papers to have to write with my other classes.
Oh, it was brutal.
Oh, I'm sure it was, dude. I'm sure it was.
But I liked him. I had him for British Empire and World War One.
Nice. I would have liked to have definitely done both those classes, but with the classes I still had to take, it was like, no. But anyway, what can you do? So let's see here. I guess we'll move on down to the top of page 27. Pinky. I looked this up.
Pinkertons.
Okay. I was wondering if that could have been the case, because I was like, what could a pinky be? So I looked it up as pinky as slang online, and it gave me nothing.
I was trying to think of an insulting way to say Pinkerton.
Okay.
I don't know if it worked. It didn't work.
Okay. I think it'll work. I'm pinky. I'm no pinky either, Joshua said. Okay. Alrighty. And then a little bit further down, Cranston Brody grinned like a wolf around his cigar. Did he have a cigar this whole time?
That is a legitimate question.
Okay. Fair enough. Warning, switch to first person. I didn't want to take the time to change now. Fair enough. I totally get that. Okay, and then this is section 6. We're coming into kind of a whole different thing here. And it's kind of like now for something completely different. It's a flashback, kind of a fever dream, if you will, before she has, I guess, come to this world from where her people had gone centuries ago. And I like a lot of the imagery that goes down in here with the tree and the stairs that shape into it or out of it, and how she's walking down barefoot and they're so smooth that she's not even concerned about the slightest chance of a sliver. And just the whole natural feeling of this, palace would be the right word.
That's what I'm calling it. It kind of doesn't feel right, but I can't think of anything else.
Ah, fair enough. I mean, for me, palace works as far as like kind of how I understood how the tree is grown in the middle of this place, and the canopy kind of comes out like, I guess, the roof, and then the branches come out and act as like, I guess, a kind of a frame. Do I have that right in my head? Kind of.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I want to make sure I was imagining that right.
I'm going to try and update that description when I go through it again and change it from first to third person. And I'll probably just call it a palace because I don't want to get too freaking cute with it. But it's just, it's a gigantic tree and it's been shaped into a home.
Okay.
So it's like a living tree still.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay. And it's like right in the middle of this, like, we'll just say palace mansion kind of.
No, it is the palace mansion.
Oh, the tree is the palace mansion, right?
Yes.
Okay. The tree isn't in the center of it.
No.
Like the whole tree is this. Wow. That's a lot of branches. At least with how I see it anyway.
Yeah. I guess I got to work on that because I don't have any branches necessarily. So the walls, like, it goes up and the walls go up and they've been formed, you know, these teardrop windows, large teardrop shaped windows all around that let light in, and you can see outside, and the roof is just the leaves and stuff. And I didn't really get into the rest of the building or the rest of the, I'll just call it a building. I didn't get into the rest of the building. Most of the action just takes place in this ballroom.
Okay. Alrighty then. I will look forward to seeing these descriptions kind of develop as they do.
Yeah, I'm not.
You're not? Fair enough.
I spent 3 hours playing with the first paragraph before I quit.
Wow.
Before I quit and just put it all back to the way it was and just cut and paste it in there.
Wowza. Yeah.
I was like, it's time to move on.
Too true. 3 hours, man. I mean, that's no small stint, dude.
I was dividing my attention between other things. You know, when I get sick of it. So it might have been 3 straight hours. Might have been more like almost 2.
Still a lot, though, for a paragraph. Still a lot.
I want the ballroom floor. I was trying to describe it. I tried to change it to like a tree, maybe that had fallen and was still alive. But I was describing the ballroom floor is, you know how trees have those rings?
Yes.
So it was like smooth and polished, and the rings, you know, are going out from the center of this dance floor.
I like that. That's cool.
I picture my head, but I couldn't get it into words.
That can be kind of tricky to really capture that. I'm sure you can do it though, but yeah, it'll probably take some, you know, some sorcery, some word sorcery.
No, this ain't a footnote. This is, this mark that you have here asking if this one's a footnote.
Yes.
I think this is from me copying, pasting from the previous document. I think that's just when you turn it into another document, it's it numbers the comments.
Okay. I see. Yeah. Cause I had seen like a bunch of them and I was like, what's going on here? But I do like how this scene develops, and I like knowing what's on the surface and the confusion of the deeper moment, because it's like with the people having no faces and they have like blurred visages, and she's just also in a total confusion about like what this moment is, why it's significant, why she's even there. Yeah, it feels superficial in that way, but it's also really good with kind of imagery in the deeper end of kind of the visual dream itself. I like the duality that kind of exists there. I liked this too, the sensory detail. My heart thumped against my breast hard enough to rattle my bones. I liked that. And I had just some minor edits mostly in this section. Let's see. I mingled among the guests. but none would look at me, and fear prevented me from speaking.
I lost my place. It was on...
Oh, 28. Let's see. I mingled among the guests, but none would look at me, and fear prevented me from speaking. The fear prevented me from speaking was my replacement for I was too filled with fear to speak, kind of felt passive. Didn't really have a whole lot on this page. Another faux footnote. I think there was like six of them all together, I think.
All right, I'll look for them.
We'll move down to page 29 and down to chapter 7. The sun struck the woman's eyes when the woman opened them. Okay. Wow. I totally went somewhere else with that when I read it. Because first I was like, I projected onto this hardcore. Because I was like, were there curtains? Did somebody open the curtains? How did she open the curtains when she was sleeping? Never mind.
Okay.
I'm just going to mark that as resolved. And let's see. I like how this starts off with her getting woken up and just feeling racked with exhaustion. Barely even able to like keep her hand up. And let's see. The light was extinguished with a bang and the cool dark enveloped her again. And I'm assuming the bang was the shutters on the window.
Yeah.
Okay. Because Elsa's in the room. And that's who says, I'm sorry, whispered a small voice. I was just trying to see. Okay. All right. I did like the inventory usage in this section here. The bed the woman lay in was just large enough to hold her and wedged against the back wall. There was a three-drawer dresser against one wall with a framed picture of a woman on top, as well as a wooden pitcher and tin cup. A single shelf held a sewn doll, several books, and wooden figurines. So I especially like the frame picture and the dolls and the figurines, because this with the wooden figurines and the doll makes me think that this is Elsa's room.
Right.
Let's see here. Then we get a little bit of dialogue between the strange woman and the little girl. I like the hiya. The girl replied in a whisper. I like that. Just kind of that. That nervous, okay, I guess I should say hi back, but I'm going to do it in a cute way. Because I'm, like, nervous. And oh, she gets her water from the pitcher. And I liked this description here. The girl watched the woman drink with the rapt wonder of a scientist who discovered a new species of animal. Elsa offers up her name, and she says, people call me Els.
Okay, question.
Yeah.
Up until that point, I was really struggling and worried about, I have two women here talking, neither one of them been identified. I was worried about all the hers and she's that were going around being confusing.
I didn't really have a problem with it because I know what was being gone for here, which is we have the strange woman. So, I mean, what else are you going to refer to her as?
You didn't really mark anything, so I'm guessing it was okay.
Yeah, I didn't really have any problems with it, because when it's the woman, it's the woman. And then when it's Elsa, it's made clear that, you know, either it's a small voice or refer to her as the girl. So girl versus woman, that helped me differentiate between the two characters and as they were sharing the dialogue here. Definitely it got a little bit easier once Elsa introduced herself or took it upon herself to introduce herself. No, I didn't. I really didn't run into anything that I felt was really an issue. Hello, the woman said. To her own ears, her voice was faint and far away, an echo in a distant canyon. She felt as if her body had devoured a piece of itself. Hiya, the girl replied in a whisper. She shifted her weight. And I think with having those dialogues to create a separation of paragraph between moments with the woman and moments with the girl, I think that helps separate it out well enough that its readability is fine. To me anyway. I was good with it.
Okay.
Let's see. The remnants of her dream lingered on the fringes of her vision. I liked that. It was like everything, you know, it's like, everything was still kind of blurry for her is kind of what I got from that. with her vision and all that. See, compared to the open and luminous ballroom of the palace, the darkened room she lay in felt oppressive and suffocating. I liked that juxtaposition. Let's see, this is, and then this is where we get introduced to Charles, quiet but authoritative. Voice calls for Els. Footsteps thumped toward the blanket, and it was pulled back to reveal a tall man who had to hunch slightly to see into the room. His skin was browned granite, baked and hardened from years under the sun. Yet there was a weary kindness in his eyes when they fell on the woman. I liked this introduction of Charles Johnston here. I see you're sitting on browned. Did you have a question about that?
Oh, no, I just right-clicked it to see what it was suggesting. It wants me to use brown, but I don't know if I like it. I don't know if brown is passive. Brown is like, this is a guy who's been living in the sun. His skin has been tanned and darkened by years on the plains. Not, it's not just brown.
He's sun-baked skin cancer, dude.
Yep. All he needs is a cigarette.
Right? And then, see, I told you to leave her alone, Els, the man said. I liked this little exchange between all three of them here. It was, sorry, Papa, Els said. She was making sounds. I was just seeing if she was okay. She's been kind, the woman said. I don't know what it is about that shared dialogue there, but I like the flow of it. I like, yeah, kind of that. I just like the exchange. And then I also like how we get a little bit about Els from her father. She'd always been a curious girl. Seems she got her curiosity riled up so much she won't listen to her father. And he introduces himself. I like how he feels slighted when Avis doesn't give him her name. He's all, well, he said, I guess your name is your business. We'll see you fit, then you can be on your way. Get out of here, you rude person.
I wasn't picturing him saying it like that, but...
I don't know. It was just, yeah. Maybe he's not saying it that way, but I was just kind of like, I'm also thinking about what's coming ahead too. And I'll get to it when we get there. But she's all, I'm sorry, Charles, I don't know my name. And so they get a little bit of that. And this is where she discovers her ears have been lopped off and he sewed them.
I think she already knew that because she had that knife and stuff, but I think this is where she just gets reminded of it.
Yes, and this is where, and also, you know, cleaned and stitched, took care of her. Really, I mean, kind of shows really how kind and caring Charles is, like how selfless he is to bring a strange person into his home, especially when he's had hired gunmen and cowhands from the Brodies burning down his house he's building, killing his livestock, killing his chickens, engaging in domestic terrorism. Yeah, I mean, it just shows a lot of character for him. And I like this scene here better than the other one out of the last draft, where Avis is like awake the whole time when he brings her in and he, like, you know, offers her food and kind of starts, you know, with the medical treatment and stuff like that. I really like this better, I think, with her waking up and being confused and getting introduced to Elsa first, the curious little girl. Yeah, I'm digging this.
Okay, good.
Let's see here. I liked this passage of time drop, too. I'll feed you if I need to, Charles used the same voice he used with his daughter, kind of a gentle sternness. You need to get your strength up. 2 days of no eating isn't going to make you better. I liked that. Yeah, it was a good passage of time drop. It wasn't gaudy in its presentation or placement or, yeah, it didn't feel like out of place or like purposeful just to do it, just to sneak in a time drop. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah, I was watching Ant-Man today.
Uh-huh.
Or Ant-Man and the Wasp.
I liked that movie.
Well, the scene where the detective is talking to his daughter and just basically for the sake of the audience, I always, you know, make jokes about people explaining to us what's going to happen, like children, literally explaining everything that had happened between the last movie and this one to the child.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
For our benefit.
For our benefit. Right. Let's see here. Okay. Charles is going to take it upon himself to feed Avis since she can barely lift the spoon. He fed her with care, waited patiently for her to chew and swallow before he gave her more. And I liked that. I liked this part here between them both, because it really kind of shows a tenderness from Johnston, and also his kindness quite well beyond just helping her out in a time of need. I mean, he's like actually like taking the time to like feed her, but like not just like, eat, damn it, I'm going to just shovel it in and hope you can swallow it all. Shows a lot of patience on his part, as well as everything else. So that was cool. And I also like this description here. His hands were calloused with crooked fingers that had been broken. The sun softened the lines of his face, though there was a severity permanently etched into his expression under the gray stubble. Thick, dark hair covered his head, and blue eyes matched his chambray shirt. The black pants he wore were old with loosened threads and thin patches. I mean, you definitely got the idea that, you know, he's not a rich man by any means. He's rough. He looks rough. And definitely he's a man of the land, dude. I mean, he's also, you know, been through some interesting things with having crooked fingers that had been broken and not properly set. So I liked that detail. That was probably one of my favorite details, was the crooked fingers that had been broken. And then Avis goes back to sleep. She sleeps for several hours. I got confused with orientation of the home. Let's see. It was a struggle to get to her feet, but once she did, the woman felt better. She assumed she was in the house. She saw the day. Hang on. She assumed she was in the house. She saw the day she arrived. It seemed smaller on the inside. There was a fireplace with several stuffed chairs in front of it, a cooking area, and another room on the end. The blanket was pulled back, and the woman could see it was bigger than the room she lay in, but only because a bigger bed was stuffed into it. The fireplace and the chairs in the cooking area are in the room she was in?
No.
Or
it was a struggle to get to her feet, but once the woman did, I guess I didn't say she left that room.
Yeah, I was just, it was confusing. It confused me.
Okay.
So it was just, yeah, just confused me with the orientation of the room, the blanket, and the rest of the house. So,
because the other blanket, another room on the end, the blanket was pulled back. The other room had a blanket covering it too, not a door. So, right, yeah.
Okay.
The paragraph needs some work.
Yeah, just a little bit. But I like it. I mean, I like it otherwise. I liked this detail here. Fine ash stirred in the breeze, and she could still smell the warm soot. And this is referring to the house that he had been building. It was burned down to the foundation.
Are you still on page 33?
I am on page 34. I mean, all I had left on 33 was just a couple small edits. It was just super small. And then, yeah, we have on 34, we have Avis asking what happened here. And she sees this burned down structure, I mean, burned down to the foundation, and with, I guess, some structure left. And this would have been much larger than the building she woke up in. So this was like basically, I guess, going to be Charles Nelson's, for lack of a better term, dream house on their land.
Yeah, it was a bigger home, where the other one was just something that kind of threw up while they were building something better.
This had probably been worked on when Elsa's mom was still alive, I assume.
Yeah.
Okay. So basically there was more loss to it being burnt down than just the wood and nails and sweat.
Yeah, I don't know how deeply I'm going to get into it, but the house was basically it was like a frame, and I kind of in my mind I have like it was a frame for a long time, because after wife died, he didn't feel like building it anymore, but then got to the point where, like, well, you know, I need to build this thing, at least for my daughter or whatever. And so it wasn't even a home. It was just kind of like frame and a few walls at that point.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, it still had a long way to go with finishing building it.
Yeah. I'll probably dig into that at some point later.
Okay.
In a moment between Avis and Johnston, or maybe else. Because I feel like she's going to get most of her information about the land and the people and Johnston himself from Elsa. Because Chuck's not much of a talker.
Ah, fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. I know at times he likes to grunt. So, yeah, he just never really talked much. unless Avis was like coaxing words out of him. So yeah, Avis is in a state of anemia, and she's asking questions to figure out what's going on. And Charles tells her not to concern herself with it now. And then he changes tracks on her. I was thinking, you probably need some time to get back on your feet. Maybe think about what you're going to do next. You're welcome to stay for a spell. We could use some help when you're up for it. All we can offer is food and a place to sleep. So this, like, I'm like wondering if there was like off screen action where like Elsa was like, can we keep her?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause at first he's like, oh, well, you know, we'll get you fixed up and we'll send you on your way. And then I liked Elsa playing with the horse, and yeah. And her being so enthralled with, you know, being a real horse. But I think everybody's enthralled with the horse being a real horse since they haven't been around for what, centuries?
Yeah.
And I noticed the arrival to the choosing of a name for her unfolds pretty much the same as the last draft, with Elsa suggesting Martha, and then Elsa kind of tiptoeing around that. And then, but I like the addition of, and I think this was new, She names her after a belted kingfisher, which was a sketch of a bird in one of her mother's books. Was that new, or was that in the last draft?
Yeah, that's new.
Okay, I had a feeling that was new, and that's on page 35, and also on the top of page 35, there was a POV shift. I know you already made that disclaimer up at the top, but I figured I'd highlight it.
Yeah, that's not supposed to be there.
And we end with Avis reunited with her horse and them interacting with each other. And she wonders what kind of world it could be that didn't have horses. So, yeah, I like the work you did here. I mean, I think some of my favorite stuff was definitely with her waking up and meeting Charles and Elsa. I think that was some of my favorite stuff. But I also liked the contention that comes in much sooner between Joshua and Cranston as a result of Sheriff Teague's tampering, if you will.
Yeah, I was going to put something in there too. You've been talking to Sheriff or Sheriff Boise, but that kind of didn't end up coming out.
That's okay, because I think it's kind of one of those unspoken things. And also that sets up things for Joshua to be playing the investigator role and not, I guess, be hired on as more of a gunman, but more as the investigator outside of Teague. So I think that will play well when he's off on his investigations going around.
Yeah, I thought maybe it'd be more reason. I don't know. I'm kind of torn because I feel like it doesn't put the... Because like in my first draft, he just took the job sight unseen. And then he was like, oh, God damn it, I'm stuck with this job because I got to do it.
Right.
I got a contract to fulfill. And that's where he's under that pressure. He's trying to diffuse situations and handle the problem without killing people. And I'm wondering if this way maybe he gets a little too much freedom.
Oh, yeah, huh? Maybe. I think there's different things you could probably throw in, especially with Caroline. Because I know that there's stuff going to be coming up between him and Caroline if it's going to be kept in. She could have some influence on him, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, Cranston's still kind of a bully, and, you know, Andy's still a hothead and whatever. So, I mean, there'll be tension. I'm going to try and keep it the same. Have Joshua still be that nagging voice of Cranston?
Yeah, that voice of reason.
But I feel like the screws will be less. So I'll see how it plays out.
Indeed. I'm looking forward to seeing how it plays out under this setting of expectations opposed to the last draft. So it'll definitely be interesting to see where it goes.
All right. I don't have anything else. Do you have anything else?
No, that's it, man.
All right. So, hey, people listening, thanks for joining us. Once again, Pacific Novel Project. Find us on patreon.com/Pacific Novel Project. We're going through the editing process. We started from our very first drafts. Now we're deep into the drafting process, and we got some short short story word challenges, and hopefully be contests if we get enough patrons, and you know, money will go to publishing our books, publicizing them, art, whatever we need to do if we need to do stuff on our own. Discover how it goes in real time.
Real time. I like it.
Slow and ponderous much of the time.
Indeed.
But we're getting there. We're getting there.
We are. You know, you got to start with the foundation, you know, build it up. Hopefully nobody comes along and burns it down.
I know, man. Motherfuckers.
At least we're not nesters.
That's right. Good night to you and good night to everybody else.
Good night. Thank you for listening.